Testing, testing. This is the Senate Committee on Business, Housing, and Finance, March 10th, 1987. Work session on House Bill 2216, Senate Bill 145, 146, 147, 148, Senate Bill 57, 58, and 59.
Couldn't hear a thing.
Yeah, what did you say?
It rose by any other name.
147.
Would smell as sweet.
Right. Okay, we're going to work. Before we move into work session, we moved Senate Bill 149 back to committee because for some reason the last amendment that was introduced by Senator Coyne was not on the bill. There really is no need to take action on the bill. We have everything is straight now. We're going to send that back to the floor.
It's on the floor already. I got an honest area.
Oh, good. All right.
You have a very efficient staff.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. Super
Thank you,
efficient.
Senator Coyne. Thank you so very much.
Which one do we have first?
Let's go with that one.
All right. Well, first, we'll go into work session then on Senate Bill 147 first. Mm-hmm. Bob, would you tell us what we have?
Yes. To the chair and the committee, Senate Bill 147 came before us on a prior occasion and deals with the collection, the charging and collection of fees from institutions that are regulated by the Financial Institutions Division. During the previous hearing and work session on this matter, there was just a question dealing with the unification of a date, make a date uniform for all of the licensees to make their payments of fees to the department. In that regard, there was a proposed amendment brought on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association to speak to that particular concern of a date, and I believe Paul is here to speak further to that.
Chairman Hill, members of the committee, my name is Paul Arntzen. I'm the administrator of the Financial Institutions Division, Department of Commerce. We were back before you approximately 10 days ago and discussing this, and there was some discussion with the Oregon Bankers Association and ourselves, and we have come to an agreement in terms of wording on the bill. You have before you proposed amendments to Senate Bill 147. This rewrite is a little more extensive than was probably necessary. However, it does hit the mark in terms of our interests as well as the interests of the financial institutions. The gist of this is that this would permit the supervisors of various sections with the concurrence of the administrator to set the date for collection of the various fees of the industries by rule. The intent here is to level out the cash flow problems that the division has experienced in the past. As the committee may recall, last time we met, we have a variety of dates for collection of our fees, all the way from July 1st for the savings and loan industry, April 15th for the banking industry, January 15th for the credit union area, and consumer finance is kind of a bill-as-we-go process.
Senator Coyne.
Well, yeah, I think we understand that. My question is, how come you don't have, you have not filled in the blanks in your amendment? And could we get to the amendments?
Chairman Hill, Senator Cohn, I would offer to you April 15th as a consistent date. We've had some discussion with that.
And, that's a satisfactory date? That is a satisfactory
Yes, it is. It certainly is.
Are you talking about on the amendments? This?
Yes, Senator.
There also appears to be a mock-up of the bill. They're hand engrossed.
Well, the amendments, I must say, are a bit more extensive than I would have thought. I was prepared to move the bill out today, but I guess with these, I think we'll just have to hold it over, give staff a chance to look over to make sure that the amendments are appropriate.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coyne.
Do you want to move them in concept?
Yes.
Would you want a motion in concept?
Yes.
So you can come
I'd appreciate
so that
it.
You can get them passed by legislative council. Does it make any, could I also ask a question
go ahead,
before
Senator
you go through? What other material changes have you made? You've set a date and you've got the amount needed by the supervisor collecting fees to maintain a reasonable, you've added emergency fund in there so that they can add. What else have you actually changed policy-wise in terms of, I don't see very much that's.
Chairman Hill, Senator Cohen, we've materially nothing else. As I reviewed the proposed amendments, it is in fact, it appears to be somewhat shorter and a little more concise. It does not, for example, deal with each paragraph of each regulated entity in some detail. It kind of lumps it together. It appears to make it much shorter, much more direct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd move the amendments as we have presented, dated March 10th, offered by the Oregon Bankers Association, and to allow you to pass them by legislative council and see what we look like next time.
Senator Cohen, thank you, Senator Cohen, moves the amendments to Senate Bill 147 that they go through legislative council.
Mr. Chairman, with the date April 15th inserted.
With the date April 15th, in Section 2 of the amendments on the second line of Section 2. Any objections? So ordered.
You going to move the bill?
No, he wants to look at him.
No.
I mean, I'm happy to. I think he said he wanted to see MLC. I don't think it's.
Do they have any time?
I'm happy to move the bill.
Gentlemen, the members from the Department of Commerce, is there something that you have to get back to? Is that it? All right. Are you? What bills are you needed on?
I'm done.
All right. Okay. Yes. Go back. We'll take up now the work session on Senate Bill 2216. House Bill 2216. Okay, Bob.
House Bill 2216 was visited on the committee during the public hearing. It deals with the barbers and beauty beauticians. And it has went through sunset review. It deals with some housekeeping things, preserves the board. And there were no other changes to this legislation with the exception of an amendment that came in before to delete manipulating on page 1 of the printed bill, line 16. Susan Wilson is here to speak to the measure if there are any questions on behalf of the committee. There is no fiscal impact, by the way, on this bill as well.
All right. I'm now, were there no amendments then to the bill at all?
Just,
yes, there's one.
Just one.
Mm-hmm.
To delete the word manipulating out of line 16. On page 1 of the bill.
All right. Did we act on those on that amendment?
I'm not sure if we acted on it in the public hearing. We need to act on the amendment. We didn't act on the amendment. Did we?
No. We're going to move the amendments out. Proposed amendments to House Bill 2216.
Was this amendment from yourself?
No.
All right. Now, as I recall. No, we did not act on this amendment. I don't think we really had any intent to act on this amendment.
Does anybody know where
to delete the word manipulating?
No, I don't think there was any testimony to that regard, that amendment.
Yes, then I'm prepared to accept a motion on House Bill 2216.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Frey.
On line 17 of page 1 now, well, I've got two questions, I guess. Is this the singular or the plural spelling of vertebra? I should know the answer to that. It seems to me that that's the plural spelling that I'm looking at here. Who knows? Is it?
They both concur as the plural.
I think you're correct.
Well, then it shouldn't be, though, should it? If I'm correct, then it's we shouldn't be using it this in here.
It's
So, and I take it, Mr. Chairman, that the intention here is that the masseur or the masseuse or whoever is doing the massaging could work at the level of the sixth vertebra and above. The way this is worded here, it would not permit work on the neck at the seventh vertebra. That's the way the bill's worded. Is that the intention of the sponsor? You see what I mean?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frey, I think you're correct. I think it should be the singular form, and that was the intention.
And because the intention is to allow work on the entire cervical part of the spine, which would include the first seven vertebrae, wasn't that it?
Right. It'd be just allowing massage in the back of the head and the neck.
Well, if it's to include if it's to include the entire cervical portion of the spine, then it would include the seventh vertebra. And if that's what you want, then you'd probably want to change the wording here, to say above the, either the eighth vertebra or something, right? Right now, you can't work on the area of the neck which is at the seventh vertebra.
That's where they want it, apparently.
I think that's where they want it.
Do they? Yes, all we want is the allowance of working on the head.
Is
neck attached right here and not any further down.
Okay, well, what we need then is the language, whatever it is that you would like to.
First seven words.
Okay.
Consider
the cervical. Could I consult back and forth?
Surely.
Sorry, I had to hold that up on that.
I don't know who's going to count, Mr. Chairman. Who's going to prove?
The intent, Chairman Hill, Senator Frey, is to work from the neck up. If this is it appears this is a typographical error, and the seventh vertebra was the correct. I'm not a scientist, so I can't.
I'm not either. Well, if you want to include the entire neck, then it covers the first seven vertebrae of the spine. Am I right or wrong on that?
That's right.
That's right. Okay.
All right, then. What do you have some language that would...
Well, Mr. Chairman, you just have to say above the eighth if you want to do that. If that's what your intention is.
I think that's what you want to do.
Above the eighth?
I think that's correct, yeah.
Or either above the eighth or... including the seventh.
Obviously, we weren't prepared for this question.
Okay, so on line 17 of the printed bill, delete the word seventh.
Mr. Markey, may I have a suggestion, Mr. Chair?
I'm not sure that I trust Markey's counting either.
Depends on which end you start counting from, actually. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Markey, for Oregon Hairdressers Association. I don't really think it matters if you say seventh or eighth. Frankly, that language was put in and replaced the word body. And really, the only thing that people are talking about is massage of the head, which normally wouldn't include the neck anyway. Seventh is fine with cosmetologists and hairdressers who are working in the industry. I think that Senator Frey raised a good point that vertebrae is probably plural. You can add an E and make it singular. That's fine, but I think that's a typographical error probably. So that's not, it's just not a problem with anybody in the industry.
Correct that on the Senate bill to be passed and typos to be corrected in the printing state.
Okay.
You wouldn't have to mess with all of them. We'll leave it at 7th.
All right. Make a motion.
You mean on the what, on the bill?
Are there any further questions on the bill as a whole?
Yes, I'd move the bill, Mr. Chair, the floor of the Duke Pass recommendation.
Senator Frey moves House Bill 2216 to the Senate floor of the Duke Pass recommendation, and also we'll implement the rule that allows a correction of typographical errors for the bill. Before the bill hits the floor. Any discussion?
So the only thing we're going to change is the A to the E, right?
Yes. Or, I'm sorry, do you, or is an E added on to the N?
That's the way I do it, but I don't know if that's correct. It's A-E.
It's A-E.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay. The clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. The carry of the bill will be Senator Kenemer.
Good. I want to ask you some questions.
The next bill we'll take up will be Senate Bill 145.
Mr. Chairman, to the committee, Senate Bill 145 is the commodities legislation that we took up in a public hearing dealing with providing warnings and procedure that the department can utilize to issue cease and desist orders against persons outside of the state that are engaging in activities that are not in the best interest of Oregon consumers of commodities. There have been proposed amendments to the bill, and some additional information came over today from Mr. Brooks, other division. The commissioner of the department is with us today to answer further questions with regard to Senate Bill 145.
As I recall, we were concerned about the basic need for this bill, and I guess that's the first thing that we should hear about, because there are a number of questions that I recall were raised, I believe, particularly by Senator Frye, as to what good this bill would actually do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jane Edwards, the Corporation Commissioner. What I brought along today was an example of the kind of problem we're faced with. We gave you some material on Wind River Mining Company. And it.
Let's see, do we have? Yes. It's in our
big
files.
Big fat file stuff here.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I saw it. Yeah, I looked. Oh. Yeah, I forgot. I guess. What did I do with it?
Oh, I put it in a different folder.
In front of you.
It's material. It looks like this.
Yes.
And what this, and this is what we call a typical California boiling room operation. And if you turn to a couple of pages in, what you can see, the first material you get is a discussion of the value of gold. The brochure we had was nice and colorful, and here nice pictures of gold. And you get into the material and what these people are selling, and they're offering to sell this right now in Oregon. I mean, we got this information because people called us, they were being solicited. And what these people claim is that they have a gold mine in southwest Washington, and that they are producing gold at the rate of about 300 tons per day of gold, and that you can buy this gold for about $250 an ounce, which is less than the price of gold, and you can get delivery in 15 months. And they give you a very nice and certificate that you will get when you send your $250 to them. And of course, you can order more than 1 ounce of gold. That's the material. It looks like this. And that would be what you would get if you wanted to enter an agreement with these people to get the gold in 15 months. Now, when we got this information, we called the forest rangers in southwest Washington, where this gold mine is alleged to be, and found there's no gold mine. They've had a number of inquiries. There's nothing going on there. And furthermore, these people have a claim on that land that they're alleging to mine. So we said, well, this is a fraud. Now, folks are operating in California. They've got some contacts in the state of Washington. To our knowledge, they have not physically come into the state of Oregon, and yet they're soliciting this in Oregon. Now, what does the current law do about this problem? First, our office has no jurisdiction. These folks are selling gold. They're not selling a security. The federal government, under the commodities law has no jurisdiction because, again, the people are claiming to sell gold, not a future interest in gold. Now, I will say parenthetically, as a practical matter, if I called these folks, what they would tell me is, look, you go ahead, send us your money. You don't have to take delivery after 15 months. Go ahead, send us your money. We'll hold on to it. And if the price of gold goes up, we'll sell it as a profit. You'll get the profits. It's maybe a futures contract, but it is not structured in that way to avoid the federal law. So I could talk to the Department of Justice, which I have done, and Tim Wood had hoped to be here today from their financial fraud unit. It's not illegal under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, because that deals only with consumers' goods, and this is not a consumer good, okay? Now, it is probably illegal under the RICO law. It's probably theft by deception. You could probably bring a criminal action. You could bring a racketeering action against these folks. The problem is they're out of state. Probably very difficult to even find them, to arrest them, to bring them to Oregon. Now, what would I do if I had Senate Bill 145? That bill says, in a nutshell, that if you're going to sell commodities, you've got to make delivery within 28 days. The contract to sell those commodities has to provide for delivery within 28 days. That bill went into effect. What I would do is issue a cease and desist order. Now, and I would name these folks, and I would say they're operating this illegal program. Now, I recognize nobody's going to be afraid of my cease and desist order, but what I can do is give that to Randy Ripplinger, and I can get that in the press. And when I get a phone call from somebody, I can say, yes, what these folks are doing is illegal. Don't enter in a contract for this gold. The problem right now, if I get a phone call from a member of the public saying, should I get into this? And I say, look, you know, it appears to us it's no gold. It appears to us it's a fraud. But I don't even have jurisdiction to get into it. And I don't have the hard evidence. We've got the information from the forest rangers in this case that there's no gold. But I can't give a clear answer. This is illegal under the law because, right? And if these folks were more sophisticated, their gold mine wouldn't be in Southwest Washington. It'd be in South Africa. I mean, and then we would be extremely difficult to prove it's a fraud, although we would always sense that. So I guess the answer is what this bill would do is it allows us to tell the public this is per se illegal. These contracts are illegal. Don't enter into them. It allows us to do publicity.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Frye.
Would this bill make something, a contract illegal that's presently legal?
Yes. To the effect that if there was a contract right now, a contract such as what's being proposed here is legal, except for the fact that there's no gold. It's a fraud. But other than that, it's legal. Now, let me answer this. The concern when you do a commodities bill is, am I going to just interrupt commercial transaction? A farmer is selling his wheat. He has a contract to sell it in the future. And the bill has a number of exemptions for commercial transactions, sales among merchants, sales by farmers of agricultural products that they themselves have grown. So those kinds of transactions would not be affected. But the contract I've described here, and that we have a copy of, would be made illegal under that bill, whereas now, yeah, I can enter into a contract with somebody to get gold delivered in 15 months.
Well,
excuse me, Jane, Senator Frye, we're having a problem here with our system. Oh. So something need to be done right now. Okay, let's... Okay, thank you. Senator Frye.
Yes, Mr. Chair, a couple of questions. The first question is, well, you said one reason we might need this is because if it could be, the situation might be fall under the RICO Act or some section of the theft statute, and I think that's correct, but you indicated you might have, or we might have a hard time finding these people, but yet you'd have the same problem yourself in finding them, wouldn't you?
Yes, Senator Frye, what I would do is attempt to serve them through publication or through whatever method. But let me, and you're correct, I would have the same problem with the RICO. The problem with the RICO statute is you have to file a civil lawsuit. In our case, we'd have to pay the Attorney General $50 an hour to do that. They would name these folks. They may or may not get service, go through service by publication, whatever, and potentially get a default judgment against them or potentially win. But the concern is that every day these folks are in business you know, they're making $1,000 or more. That money is just simply rolling in. The thought is what you'd like to do is consumer awareness. I guess the other practical, there's so many of these, it may not be practical for the Attorney General to attempt a RICO in every case. As a policy, they don't like to file those when they're out of state. And I mean, I'm not criticizing them because, you know, getting service and hunting these people down and getting the, you know, going in and getting temporary restraining orders and all of that takes a fair amount of work. I suppose what it really comes down to is you want a quick and dirty, kind of a strike sort of effort. And I can do an administrative order, get that signed, get that to the press, you know, attempt to make service pretty quickly.
What would this cease and desist order do that you're talking about?
It would say they could cease and desist offering contracts that are prohibited under this law. And they're prohibited because they provide for delivery in greater than 28 days.
Now, they're going to have to, they're entitled to a hearing, of course, aren't they?
Certainly. And if they request a hearing, they'd get a hearing.
Well, they're entitled to a hearing before the order's issued, aren't they?
Well, no, they aren't. Because this bill, like the securities laws, is kind of funny. It talks about you issue an order, then you have a hearing, and you have a final. And you have a final order. So in effect, what you've done is done a proposed order. But you can make it an immediate, I mean, you can make it effective immediately under the Administrative Procedures Act if you show compelling circumstances and that sort of thing.
Well, you could take this material right here and go to a circuit court judge and say that we got on the phone and we, and based on what the sheriff has, whatever county it is up there, told us, we believe that this is a fraudulent act, and you can get the judge, you think, to sign a cease and desist order based on that.
Well, the Corporation Commission would sign a cease and desist order.
Oh, I see. You'd sign this yourself.
Right. And
okay, so would, you could sign a cease and desist order yourself then, and, well, okay, that's interesting.
Senator Cohen.
Having been the recipient of several dozens of constituents who've had been wiped out by similar kinds of people and found when they come. Their first call is to the Corporation Commissioner, and she says, well, it doesn't fit under any of the laws, I can't really do anything, and then they go, and then we all try to get the federal, you know, see if we can't wrap in some federal pieces to get it going. And to the extent to which these people who are being, and at least it seemed to me what happened, at least in my district a couple of years ago, was a group of people would be contacted, one or two or three would buy them, they'd sort of convince other people in the neighborhood that it was a good idea, and pretty soon you'd have a dozen people having bought these things that were worthless, kind of oil wells and wherever they were. And we had no, it was very frustrating to try to cope with it. I guess even if I'm willing to support it enthusiastically, to just say, let's get the commissioner some authority to issue an order so that the neighbors won't be duped into doing it, even though you probably never get a recourse and you never get recovery for the people who've actually paid money. But somewhere, if you have on record that these people, naming them, have are not legitimate, then I think you do offer some consumer protection just in the sense of having the first people who got burned be able to sort of disseminate the information around. I found most of it happened in retired people who get really duped on this kind of thing, and they kind of talk to their the circles, and it's been a very frustrating kind of thing for me to try to cope with, and I know it has been for the commissioners out there. So I'm supportive. I don't know that it does anything in a very, very dramatic legal sense, but I think it does give some way to sort of put into the paper or make public those orders to say that someone has told them to stop doing what they're doing. Someone official. So that's my comments. Are there any, did you offer any amendments?
Yes, we did. Primarily to clean up some language, I think you have this in your packet, one concern from the Federal Commodities Futures Trading Commission, to make sure that the people they regulate are not covered under this law. And so we put an amendment to make sure that occurs.
For the record, those are SB 145-1, amendments dated 3987.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't know how the other committee members feel about it, but that's just my, in spirit of a work session here.
Let me just add one thing, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I get calls quite a bit from the media saying, well, what should we tell the public? What should tell them to watch out for? You know, give us in 10 words or less what we can put on the air. And when you're talking about these kinds of pictures, it's, you know, I look at them and I say, I'm a fraud. You can look at them and say, they're a fraud. But what can you tell the public to watch out for? Always watch out for any gold deal. They're legitimate. I mean, you know, coin shops are legitimate. They sell gold. Always watch out for oil wells. Well, obviously, they're legitimate interest in oil wells. But I'd like to be able to say, hey, anytime you're buying a contract for gold and any other commodities, if you're not getting delivery, then don't enter into that contract. It's just that simple. Those contracts are illegal. And I could say it maybe not in 10 words, but in 15 or 20 words. And that is the way you can get information to the public, primarily an unsophisticated public that can't tell these programs from legitimate programs.
Any further questions or discussion?
Mr. Chair, I had marked, and I maybe reading it will tell, section 18 on page 5. The courts of the state shall have jurisdiction over any person, including a non-resident of the state, who engages or is about to engage in any act or practice constituting a violation of any provision of this act or any order or rule. A legal question, does the court have jurisdiction over a non-resident, and how does he handle that? And second, how do we determine when a person is about to engage in an act?
Loan loss reserve also, and I said no, because the type of...
No, just tell me, you don't normally do it for other financial institutions?
It doesn't go into capital, yeah.
Okay, you just play, it's common.
There's a special type of loan loss reserve.
I understand that. I just want to know why, if I want to make sure if we're attempting to parallel institutions,
yeah.
I want assurances that we're in fact paralleling the loan loss reserve accounting process in the same way we do any other financial institutions, and if we're not doing it in the same way, I'm interested in knowing why. And those are
I can't answer that question with precision with respect to how we account in different banking areas. So I'll have to either defer to someone or I can come back to you. But basically what we're accepting is that loan loss reserve where we think a loan isn't going to make it, and therefore we reserve specially for that loan. And we think that reserve should not be included in a definition of capital, because we're just saying we think it's going to be lost anyway. And it should not add to the solvency of the institution, because you're going to lose it.
I understand. I've just been through the whole insurance business up in judiciary, so you'll understand why.
Right.
I have a little...
Mr. Chairman, may I have leave to communicate with your committee in writing to explain it, to see if...
That's fine.
This is consistent.
This is the question I want to put on the table to make sure we look at, and
yeah.
If you want it.
That's fine, Mr. Gashi. You can do that.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Simmons.
I recall in raising the term reserves, I noted that on page 1, line 10, you deleted regular reserve and put in reserves.
Yes.
And on line 41 of page 3, you put in regular reserve again. And I'm wondering what a regular reserve is.
Go ahead, Lewis.
Yes, Senator, excuse me for the delay. In Mr. Higashi's prior testimony, the explanation for replacing guarantee fund with the regular reserve was that under prior legislation, the guarantee account was the only reserve account required. The 1981 amendments to this chapter required a regular reserve as well as a special reserve. And we're talking about what percent of the credit union's reserves can be made as a loan. And the point was, the intention here was to clarify that only the regular reserve is intended.
And what is a regular reserve?
Sort of like the insurance company.
Yeah.
As opposed to a special reserve, which is reserved for a particular loan, I gather. And that's why I guess I want to...
Well, is yes. regular well, reserve defined in the...
I believe so. And special reserves are things that you can set up yourself, like reserve for moving the building to somewhere else and that sort of things. And we wanted to make sure that those reserves didn't get included in the computations.
But is regular reserve defined mm-hmm. in the statute?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Simmons, it is not defined.
What is it then?
Everything that is not a special reserve.
Everything at anybody's discretion is just like the insurance companies. What kind of a regulator are you?
Well, it just says a regular reserve. It doesn't say plural, so it must be... I would think if I were going to walk into a credit union and find out what their regular reserve is, where would I look?
In the statutes which provide for the reserves to be set up, and those are what I would refer to as regular reserves, and the special reserves are those that you voluntarily create accounting-wise outside of the reserves required by statute.
But there are no definitions.
That's true.
Mr. Chairman, there is a statute that explains how it is to be used,
okay.
and that might help. May I read that?
Sure.
Okay.
Certainly.
Provides what? That the regular...
What's the citation again?
Excuse me, it's 723.636. The regular reserve established under 723.631, subsection 1, shall belong to the credit union and shall be used to meet losses except those relating from an excess of expenses over income and shall not be distributed except upon liquidation of the credit union or in accordance with the plan approved by the supervisor. So at least that explains what's done with it.
Yes.
That's as far as I can go. That's all I know.
You're not the policy person, yes. Honestly. Appreciate that,
it is a technical question I'm not prepared to answer right now, but I can bring someone back.
Well, Senator Simmons raises the question of whether we should have definitions in the statutes of what these terms are, and I think that is appropriate. I think that would be desirable.
Mr. Chairman, at least I would like some. I'd like for you to go back to the financial divisions and give us a comparison of the kind of reserving that's required for other financial institutions and their definitions, and just see whether it's appropriate. It may not be appropriate. I just want to take a look at how that works. But I may be off base.
My point is that if we, when we're writing a law, don't know what we're mandating, it would be a little hard for someone to comply with it or for a supervisor to say to someone, you're not complying.
Yes.
I mean, I know what a regular fellow is, or a regular gal.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Well, I used to.
Well, I can't define one, Mr. Chairman, but I know one when I see one.
Yes. What we could do, let's, first of all, before we, I would like to have those definitions laid out as Senator Coyne has requested. And I guess how long will it take you all to do that? How much time would you like to do that?
Mr. Chairman, are you asking just for definitions, just to know the difference, or for the purpose of amendment?
Well, we'd like to know. I'd just like to know from around what the words mean. If you give us a definition of, perhaps we can insert the actual definitions in statute. I think this is what we're really leading to, so that when people read them, they will know what exactly it is. I mean, maybe people other than banking people exactly what these what the definitions mean. And I'd just like to know the distinction between them.
Mr. Chair, there may be a term that's defined in regular accounting procedures which would tell us what it is, and that could be something. I assume these other amendments will have to go by legislative council for form.
Yes.
So we're not delaying the bill.
Mr. Chairman, would you like us to move the amendments then?
Yes.
And get going on that, and then bring back something, and if Lewis could be prepared to consult with the chair about
yes.
a definition or and a range of definitions or whatever, so we could.
Yeah, when they removed it in one place and put it back in another, then makes me wonder why.
And yes, a specific explanation as to Senator Simmons' concern, the difference between on page one, and then it's reinserted again on page three.
What other amendments do we have? We just got.
Yes, I think the only amendment, am I correct, Mr. Gashi and Lewis, the amendments dated 3587, are those the only amendments that you are offering? Or were there other amendments that you had offered? As I understand it, the amendments dated, I believe, 22487 are actually superseded by the ones dated 3587.
Mr. Chairman, that is all on that bill.
And then we have the submitted by the financial institution.
Yes, and we'll have someone to come up and explain what those are about.
Well, they're here. Have you seen them?
Yes, we have.
Do you have any problem with the technical piece of
I had no.
Lewis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I had no problems.
Can I ask Tom whether he has any philosophical policy?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, I have no problems operationally with that bill. The principal part, as I understand, is that the last page where right now the law requires that the paid note be returned to the borrower after payment, and but operationally some of the finance companies have their loan agreement and the all of the documents on one document, the front and the back side, where after the payment is made, they're not able to physically separate it and return it to the person. And it's just a matter of resolving a business practice that is developed, and I think as long as it's paid and there's evidence of acknowledgement of payment from the lender, I see no operating problems, and I don't see where anyone is that the rights of any consumer are diminished by that proposal.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Simmons. Mr. Gashi, is it still required that they keep that the lender keep the truth in lending statement for 2 years after the loan is paid to display to a federal examiner if he so desires?
Mr. Chair, Senator Simmons, yes.
And so if the note is incorporated in that statement, then if he gives the note back, he's violating state law, and if he doesn't, he's violating federal law.
Yeah, so you get. And if they do it on separate documents, it would solve our problems.
Yeah.
But by practice or whatever, they want those things all together, so there's there's proof that I suppose there's proof that the Reg Z notice was given.
Mm-hmm.
When it's physically attached to it, you can certainly prove that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to take a fair amount of time with this, but I gather what they're deleted is, it says restore, the deleted language talks about, and return to him the canceled note evidencing the loan.
Yes.
But the substitute language says return to the borrower the canceled note evidencing the loan, or alternatively acknowledge in writing to the borrower that the loan has been repaid.
Yes.
Okay. Legislative council ought to look at that word alternatively and see if when I hope we get these things passed through legislative council so that we get conformity.
Yes.
If we're going to do that.
And I have, at least in my packet, I guess I have two different sets of amendments. I have one with a date. These are the amendments that are submitted by the Oregon Financial Services Association. One with dated 2/26/87 on the top, and I have another.
Oh, okay. I guess on the back there is one. March 10th.
I think the date has been inserted by the committee administrator. Neither one of mine has a date.
Yes, only one of mine has a date. In fact, I only have one, and that date is March 10th.
Well, mine is folded. I mean, those could have been ones that were given to me.
I believe they're identical.
I have a folded
identical
one, yeah.
They may be identical.
Maybe, Mr. Chair, we could suggest to Mr. Burns' office that they date these so that we can identify them a little more concisely.
Yeah, they look identical.
Well, we will, can we at least conceptually move the amendments?
Yes, please.
I'm willing to do that.
Senator Simmons moves the proposed amendments submitted by the Oregon Financial Services Association to Senate Bill 148. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we will submit this to legislative council and have the bill engrossed.
You definitely
did we move?
No. I'm sorry?
Did we move the amendment of the Commerce on 3587?
Senator Simmons moves the amendments from described as Commerce, Senate Bill 148, dated 3587. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Gentlemen, could we have how long do you need to get this definitional material to us?
Can I have till about Wednesday next week?
Yes, Wednesday of next week will be fine, and perhaps we can move it up for work session. Maybe I'm getting ahead of ours. We'll have those. We'll put those on for work session really as soon as possible. But Wednesday we would like to have
Tuesday?
Those. Pardon me?
You want it Tuesday? If I may respond from the committee to Mr. Higashi, the sooner the better.
Okay. It's Tuesday?
By Tuesday.
Is that enough time?
I hope so, yes.
All right. So a week from today, we'll set it for work session. All right, we'll now move into work session on Senate Bill 57.
Yes, we did visit Senate Bill 57 on a prior occasion, and the concerns that were
more than you know.
Well, that was a little humor. I said I thought we buried all those last sessions.
This particular measure came to us at the request of the Secretary of State, and in essence, it allows the Secretary of State to appoint a successor trustee to a prearranged funeral plan in the event that the current trustee goes out of business or, of course, is buried under the plan or some other item occurs, and it allows them to do that without having to go to court in order to implement such change. The OFDA indicated during the public hearing that they were interested in church salesmen being included within the coverage of this measure. No written amendment to that effect has been submitted to committee staff at the present time. However, Felicia Trader and another gentleman, Mr. Milne, I believe, from the department, are here to speak to to the measure.
Is there anything that you wanted to add to Senate Bill 57?
Felicia Trader, Deputy Secretary of State. Mr. Chairman, if there are no amendments to 57. The requirement regarding the definition of a firm, a person, a firm, or a religious organization is in Senate Bill 59. So Senate Bill 57 is before you with no amendments requested from our office.
Chairman, I move to pass.
Thank you very much, Senator Simmons. Senator Simmons moves Senate Bill 57 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. See the carrier, Senator Simmons. All right, we'll now move into work session for Senate Bill 58.
Senate Bill 58 to the committee, Chairman, to the committee, revises laws relating to endowed care cemeteries. It requires deposit of endowed care funds with trustees of funds. It provides for termination of trust and establishes procedures to be followed upon the termination of said trust. It allows trust agreements to define trust duties. It requires cemetery authority to direct investments if a trustee has passive duties. Modifies authority of cemetery authority concerning property contributed to the endowed care fund. It has no fiscal impacts in the Bill 58, and there were proposed amendments to Senate Bill 58 that was brought to the attention of the committee by the Secretary of State, whom Ms. Trader and Mr. Miles can speak to in that regard.
Now, these amendments, I assume, were submitted today. Are they dated March 10th?
Yes, they are.
All right. And does the Hannon Gross bill...
this is, Mr. Chairman, this is a substitution for the Hannon Gross bill. This is the final...
Okay.
Proposed amendment list.
So, in other words, now the Hannon Gross bill
is out of date.
Is out of date. I'm sorry.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Yes. Would you like to comment on the amendments, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Felicia Trader, Deputy Secretary of State. The amendments that you have before you combine the Hannon Gross that you looked at previously, as well as some additional request from Senator Simmons regarding definition of custodian and some further clarification there. What the amendments really do, as lengthy as they are, is pretty simple. What they do is add the provision that a custodian arrangement with a bank or savings association not qualified to engage in the trust business may be used for the investment of endowment care funds. What we did was then go through the bill and attach to the word trustee the companion words of custodian. We defined what that relationship would be, what the custodian would be expected to do, and on page 2 of the amendments you see that list of duties would be required of the bank or savings association. In addition, it allows the resignation or removal of the custodian, and finally provides a statutory reference for
for a bank or savings association. That really sums up what the amendments do. They took the Hand and Gross bill and added the additional request from Senator Simmons from the last work session.
Mr. Schrader, did these go through legislative council amendments?
No, it was our understanding that they had to come, it had to be a request from your committee.
Mr. Chairman, could you clarify that? I don't think so, Felicia. I see lots of agencies and lots of other committees that actually go to legislative council and draft amendments upon agreement. I think that would be really helpful if from now on, I think it would be better. We could have moved the bill. I mean, I feel funny about moving the bill without an LC with this, but maybe it's okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, Mr. Miles really can speak to this more directly. He worked with them on this. We had these bills drafted by the Attorney General's office since they were really prepared for us through the implementation of the last legislation. And our understanding was that when they were drafted there, that the amendments had to be prepared by LC and had to be prepared at the request of the committee. That's our understanding. We may have been misinformed.
Okay, well, maybe it's not your bill. Maybe that's right. I mean, I don't understand that, but we need to clarify.
Yes. Well, I would like for the amendments to go through legislative council. Could we get a motion then on the amendments?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I'd move proposed amendments dated March 10th from the Secretary of State, Felicia Trader. And Felicia, that then encompasses the entirety of what was offered before.
Yes.
Okay, this is fine. Okay, I'd move those amendments, and I understand we've got to take them through LC.
Yes, Senator Cohen moves amendments to propose amendments to Senate Bill 58 from the Secretary of State's office. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I have a question, then, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Frye.
Now, Mr. Miles, now. Have you had some conversation now with Mr. Spear and Eugene regarding the Masonic Lodge Cemetery Endowment Fund and so forth?
Yes, Senator Frye. Excuse me, Bill Miles, Director of Audits for Secretary of State. Yes, I've had some conversations with Mr. Spear.
Okay. Now, his concern, and so it's many members, Mr. Chair, Howard Spear of Eugene represents the Masonic Cemetery in Eugene, which has a small endowment care fund of approximately $8,000, and his concern was that the costs of setting this thing up and the charges that a bank would make to serve as a trustee would probably be prohibitive in terms of these small cemetery groups like this one. And so I know he talked to you on the phone about maybe exempting these people that have, just a minute, let me finish. That have less than, say, $50,000 in the endowment care fund. Apparently, there are six or eight rather small endowment care funds in the state. Is that, do you know about that?
Well, Senator, we did some fast calculating, and there are 17 endowment care cemeteries with endowment care funds under $50,000.
17.
Mm-hmm. Out of 67. There were 67 endowment care cemeteries that filed with us during calendar year 1986.
Okay. Well, I'd like to have some discussion on that.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah. My flowers.
Mr. Chair, I understand that the Wind River Mining Company Section 2 is interested in that kind of trusteeship and will back it with gold.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frye, we've briefed Mr. Bronner of the Oregon Bankers Association of the conversation that we've had with the people that you've talked to as well, and I think he's prepared to respond if you'd okay. care to hear from
yes,
him.
Yes, Mr. Bronner.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. The purpose, as I understand it, to insert the custodian account as an alternative to a trust department is to address the issue that Senator Frey raises. A custodian account is a savings account. We open them all the time. There is no cost and expenses. We have an endowment care facility in the community of Sandy, where I think the total funds left are in the $6,000 to $7,000 area. To operate with a trust department managing those funds, it's $500 or $600 a year, and it's just ridiculous. This bill, as amended, would allow those funds to go into a normal savings instrument, a certificate of deposit, what have you, and there would be no cost. The bank does have an added responsibility to serve as custodian, but that's defined in their duties that are before you, that's spelled out in the amendments before you, and there would be no extra cost. Now, as I understand it, your constituent also asked the question of the banker, well, what would the cost be to be a custodian? And the response was, it would be the same. But we're talking about two different things. In our trust departments, we do serve as custodians, and the fees there are about similar to what you would do if you were managing the trust. But this bill and the intent of this legislation is to provide the alternative of an endowment care fund to be deposited in a depository institution in a savings account without any extra fees.
Is the same security there that we're seeking? I mean, the purpose of the bill is to make sure someone doesn't walk off of the funds. I mean, who administers, who's got control or access to the custodian fund there?
Senator Frey, the responsibilities as set forth in the bill are that if the custodian resigns, the Secretary of State's office is notified, and there is a reporting requirement. And what's more, the funds must be on deposit. They must exist there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can I have a word with my colleague? Right. You lose your money. It doesn't make any difference whether it's a big outfit or a little outfit. The consumer loses their money.
Well, where are they going to put all these masons?
Yes, I guess we can close the work session, and we've moved the amendments to Senate Bill 58. We'll run those through Legislative Council, and we'll determine when to bring it back for work session. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 58 and move now to Senate Bill 59.
Senate Bill 59, through the chair to the committee, deals with the registration of persons marketing certain prearranged plans. When this committee visited Senate Bill 59 during the public hearing, it was emphatically expressed that churches, municipalities, and charitable organizations should not be exempt from the coverage of the reporting requirements of this measure. Accordingly, a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 59 was submitted to staff by the Secretary of State, and we put it on the computer and have a copy of the proposed amendments in the file, dealing with stating positively that no